broadcasting from Melbourne, Victoria. You're listening to the Investor Exchange. Tune in each week and listen to the guys from United Global Capital discuss the topics that matter the most to your finances. Each episode will help you separate the noise from what really matters, giving you timely and actionable information you can use. We'll cover areas related to financial markets, property, politics, personal finance, and the economy. Now, here's your host, Stephanie Sumner.
Good morning, guys, and welcome to this very scary and sad Friday, given we've gone into lockdown for another 6 weeks in Victoria. Guys, how are you feeling about that, particularly Louis and Brett, who are actually locked in Victoria? We're in New South Wales.
Don't rub it in. It's bad enough.
I shouldn't rub it in, but how is the mood, guys?
It sucks. Good for you guys. Yeah, it does suck. It's awful. Yeah. Lots of doom and gloom around. Some people are feeling resigned to it. Some people are okay to bunker down. It's just a feeling of here we go again. But a lot of people are quite depressed. And I'm personally switching between grief and anger over the situation. Just how could this happen? Ah, so frustrating.
Yeah, I hear. It is very frustrating indeed. I guess for the listeners who aren't aware, we Steph and I, we were fortunate enough to jump ship just before the border closed on Monday night. But yeah, it is absolutely frustrating, and I think many people have a right to be angry about what's going on down in Victoria. But nevertheless, there's not much we can do about it at the same time. So, you know, 6 months, 6 weeks lockdown, here we come.
Just a particularly hard time throughout winter, I think, and, you know, sort of, I mean, we've really copped it with it sort of really starting in the winter months, and it just makes it that bit harder, I think, not being able to get some sunshine and you know, feel like it's a nice warm day to be able to at least go out and buy a coffee or go for a walk and come back. So it is hard.
Yeah. Well, I went and bought a coffee this morning when I got to the office, and I don't think I saw one other person on Collins Street. It's that dead at the moment. Crazy.
Yeah. So I think it's really hit people hard because they were just starting to get some confidence back, just starting to get into a bit of a better rhythm with their lifestyles and a new normal, and socialization just coming back to a certain extent. Certainly not. Not to the pre-COVID levels, but just a bit of familiarity and return to a bit of FaceTime with certain people in certain circles. And the thing which really makes me frustrated is looking for, well, where can I blame? And it does look like there is a cause of it. It seems like the hotel quarantining program is going to bear much of the blame for this. I'm not seeing it too openly talked about, but it does seem to be where some people are subtly pointing the finger as a major cause of why we now have these community transmissions, and it seems to be pointing back towards that program not being managed properly by the private security contractors who are in there.
Yeah, it's a really hard one too. I'd just be curious to know your thoughts too around Dan Andrews and how he's handled this situation. What do you guys think? You know, I think it's kind of a tough one to make the calls and actually get it right. And it seems that across the states, a lot of the premiers have actually made mistakes along the way, which is going to happen. But how do you think he's actually handled himself, you know, throughout this whole crisis?
You're asking me. I'll throw myself into it. I think all the leaders have done a job that, firstly, no one else would want to do. Yeah. I don't think anyone would put their hand up to put themselves in that situation. And I've always my opinion so far has always been all of them are 98% on the right track. And yeah, there's missteps and there's little things that other people might have done differently, but very broadly they're moving in the right direction and doing the right things. This particular thing, I think it does go into the 2% category that that in hindsight is a mistake. But how much do you assign to Dan Andrews himself or his leadership team? Or is it something where it's fallen down on the execution side of things? Because you might have the right strategy, but if your execution fails, well, then the whole thing fails.
Yeah.
So yeah. I don't know. I find it hard to lay blame firmly. I can certainly lay anger, but that's my emotional response.
Of course, which is natural.
Yeah, and I understand anyone who's going to do that. So, yeah, I'm angry. Mm. But as far as where the blame actually lies, it's got to be partly there, but there's a lot more people who are directly involved in the execution of that particular thing. And nothing frustrates me more than incompetence. Mm. And if I look at where the – yes, there's failure, but where was failure of people trying to do the right thing but just not quite getting it right versus people who are just incompetent at their job? And I don't think Dan Andrews has been incompetent. I think the people on the ground have been incompetent. Or if it's not them, well, then it's the people who were supposed to be training or managing it on the ground who have been incompetent. Somewhere in that chain, there is a person or people who are who have been incompetent in managing that situation. And I'm not sure it's at the top. Maybe it's a little bit at the top, but there's definitely some layers to it.
He looks exhausted at the moment, though, doesn't he? When you see him on the press conferences, I tell you what, he looks exhausted and tired.
Yeah.
Just worn out. Sorry.
Look, I think the thing that is has a little bit of a stink to it is the fact that when you look at who was doing the quarantining in other states, it wasn't private contractors. My understanding was it was largely Australian Defence Force personnel and other senior forms of government officials that were largely overseeing quarantining in other states. And then when you hear that Martin Pakula, who is the employment minister, has had his union influence who the private contractors were that were going to go in and manage the hotel quarantining, there's a little bit of politics and a little bit of backslapping and giving favors back to your voting base here that probably has a little bit of a stink about it in that why did Victoria knock back other government resources, federal resources to manage these quarantining programs where other states didn't, and now we have this situation that other states don't as a result of that. So, so I think that, I think that there is some reason to question that decision-making process, in hindsight, but I agree with you, Louis. I mean, I'm trying to be fair. And I've said this to a couple of clients when I was meeting with them prior to this, and I don't know what decisions I would have made if I was in that situation. But I guess, I wasn't privy to all the information as well. But, I think there's certainly questions that are warranted to be asked.
It's a particularly worrying time for those smaller businesses too that have had to have shut up shop yet again. Obviously a lot of media around the fact that these businesses are quite likely not going to survive this next round of six-week shutdown. Real concern for what happens next to those people.
I think the other thing that is pissing people off about this is that that they've really deflected and tried to deflect any form of criticism or answer any questions that have been put to them as well. They're hiding behind this governmental inquiry that won't come up with answers until sort of September, October, while the whole well and truly after the whole fiasco is sort of passed, and they haven't even confirmed that they'll make the results of that governmental inquiry public. Mm-hmm. So there are some good reason for people to be questioning how the aftermath of this is being managed as well.
I think you guys are putting it in mild terms. I don't think there's a little bit of stink about it. I think there's a lot of stink about it. Just when you look at how big the consequences are. This is not a cold that people get or recover from. There's there's evidence now, and remember that this is a disease which is only 6 months old. So as far as the recovery from coronavirus, we've only got really 4 months of decent data on how people around the world recover from this. And what we're now finding is that, yes, there is a proportion where symptoms are mild and the recovery is easy, but there's also a proportion that have things like permanent scarring in their lungs with permanent reduced breathing capacity, permanent heart damage. There's emerging evidence of the effects of on the brain long term, but it's still too soon to qualify any of that, as well as the actual fatality rate. So I think people might have been caught up in the binary equation of, like influenza, you either die from it or you fully recover from it.
Yeah.
It's not like that. There's this spectrum of potential impacts, which are really scary, and again, just makes me so frustrated that we could be in this situation because of the incompetence of a few. Never before has the incompetence of a few affected so many, unless you're talking about war times, the incompetence of people sending troops to war. That's the only thing I can equate it to. So, yeah, I'm mad. If you didn't get a sense of that, I am mad. And look, I want to use that to dovetail into my topic for the day, because it brings me back to a book which I was actually given by someone else on a recommendation, and it's called The Resilience Project. It's by a gentleman named Hugh Van Kylenberg. And the Resilience Project is actually more than just a book. The Resilience Project is a program in Australia run firstly by the author of this book, Hugh Van Kylenberg, and now by a large team of people. And what they do is they go around to educate people on certain things that lead towards better happiness and better resilience in life. Now, this guy, Hugh Van Kylenberg, he turned what he had as a hunch on happiness in life, and he did this from – he got this hunch on happiness in life from his personal experience from spending some time in India, where he stayed in a remote village which was in extreme poverty, but his observation of the happiness of the people in that village was that they were extremely happy. They loved their lives. So he came back to Australia and he turned his hunch on happiness into evidence-based and research-based principles on how to be more resilient in life and how you can be more personally happy in life. And it's not about a denial of your current circumstances. It's just about where do you direct your focus. And he came up with the evidence-based principles of, firstly, those people who show gratitude. Secondly, those people who show empathy. And thirdly, those people who practice mindfulness have a greater sense of happiness with their life. And again, it's not about denying your circumstances. And secondly, they show greater resilience towards situations of adversity. What has he done with this now? Well, this guy has now provided education to pretty much all of the major sporting clubs around Australia. He's brought his program to every single NRL team, most if not all AFL teams, and I know Dustin Martin is one of the more outspoken advocates of mindfulness and meditation. He got it from this guy because this guy brought his program to the AFL club. Cricket Australia, but his actual passion was in taking it to schools so that children and teenagers could benefit from this his mission is to try and impact the rates of anxiety and depression among teenagers and young adults. So what he does, it's a very easy book to read. It's certainly not a hard slog. And anyone who's used to reading could devour it in an afternoon easily. And if you're not a big reader, it's a real easy book. So I do recommend it, The Resilience Project by Hugh Van Kylenberg. And he gives a little bit of a snapshot of what you can do to enhance your daily levels of gratitude, empathy, and mindfulness. And I'm going to distill it even further. So here's my tips on what you can do to help yourself through the latest coronavirus situation and through life in general. And that is, at the end of the day, take a pen and piece of paper and ask yourself two questions. Firstly, write down what went well today.
Mm-hmm.
And if you just write what went well today, it's just a way of looking at your day and picking out those things.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second question is, what am I looking forward to tomorrow? And those are two very simple questions to answer, but they are powerful in terms of how you look at the day that's just happened and
yeah.
how you view the day that is about to come. So what went well today and what am I looking forward to tomorrow?
Mm.
By writing with your hand on a piece of paper, there's something about our brain and body connection when we actually write with a pen. So that is, I think, an important part of the process. Not to keep it as a record, but just to have it refine your thinking and bring it more to the front of your mind rather than just being a thought process which you can be distracted from. So I'll put that to all of our listeners. When you finish your day today, just ask yourself, what went well today and what am I looking forward to tomorrow? And hopefully we can all just see a little bit more sunshine even through the worst and most serious circumstances that we face ourselves with.
Yeah, good well advice, Lawyer. It's certainly something that everyone should think about. We've done that in the past with saying what you're grateful for after the day, but never actually written it down. So an interesting one that it sort of makes that connection when you've actually written it on a piece of paper. Certainly something to try.
Well, hey, I hadn't thought of that, Steph. I think that's an even better way to do it if you can do it with someone else.
Yeah.
I think verbalizing it. Is even better than writing. Although
yeah.
maybe some people would find one works for them better than the other. So it's certainly better than just thinking about it in your own mind. But
yeah.
that's a great idea.
Have a conversation over dinner.
Well, yeah. I'm grateful that the football at least is on this time.
Yep.
That is true.
It's a good one, Joel. It's a good start.
Well, and Joel, let's hope at the end of the day we can write down that what went well today was our team winning.
Yes, what went well today, exactly. You know, Brett, I didn't realise this, and Hawthorn have beaten us 12 of the last 13 times we've played them.
Mate, I realise that it sucks. They're our bogey.
Yeah.
All right, anyway. You two, no more football chat. We're going to go to a very quick break, and we're going to come back after this message.
Want to learn the strategies that have achieved returns more than double the return of the average superannuation fund? Each day, clients of United Global Capital are using strategies and tactics that were once thought the domain of the professional investor or the super rich. Book your seat at UGC's Financial Fast Track Seminars, where you'll learn the science behind selecting high-performance stocks and real estate, how you can participate in advanced strategies like property development, short selling, and international investments, as well as how to protect your wealth against major adverse market events. To secure your seat, simply go to ugc.net.au/events and select the seminar that suits your needs. Seats are limited, so book your spot now.
All right, welcome back, guys. If you can refrain from talking about the football for just 5 minutes, we're going to go into our next topic for the day.
All right, set a timer.
We're going to speak to Brett now about the potential trends in the property market, during and I guess after COVID, which we haven't really got there yet. But what can you tell us about that, Brett?
Well, we'll start with a science lesson if we can. Does everyone know Newton's third law of motion?
Not in great detail.
Third law of motion.
Third law. You'll know it when you hear it, but I guess it was just sorry to spring it on you, but it's that for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I thought that was the first.
I think the first one is about an object in motion.
Space in motion.
Yeah, that's the one. Okay. I can't remember the second either, but I remember and remember the third one being the equal and opposite reaction.
That's there a good go. Science lesson, Brett.
There Excellent. You go.
I did go to school.
we cover all sorts of things here. But the reason I wanted to touch on that is there's a lot of discussion around, obviously, working environments and with people working remotely, how a lot of the office space post-COVID is likely to have significant impacts in pricing and demand because people are realizing that they can work remotely a lot more.
Yeah,
so absolutely. That's one trend. And it's not going to be clear, obviously, until post-COVID and you know, there's no restrictions and businesses start to figure out how they want to work. But the expectation from most people's perspective is at the moment is that there'll be a lot more remote working. If that's the action, well, what's the reaction to this? What else changes? And one of the things that that I saw has happened recently is the amount of search for regional properties has increased.
Yeah.
So there's a lot more people starting to look at potentially either moving out to more remote areas, so decentralizing, moving to country towns or beachside towns. And there's also been, and I know, Joel, we've had this discussion, there's been an increase in demand for people looking at holiday homes as well.
Yes, indeed.
Because they're realizing they could potentially even split their time and work more remotely. Even if they still do have an office, they can still potentially work remotely, especially with, you know, the internet being as good as it is these days and all of the technology around it allowing remote working more and more often.
Yeah.
And I suppose those searches for property were done outside of work hours too, were they?
I don't have those stats. I would actually guess probably not. But interestingly, so realestate.com have released some data about where all of their searches are happening. And the most viewed home in the last week was actually a regional property in Dural, New South Wales, that had over 300,000 views. Wow. I'm not sure that it's purely because it's a regional home or purely because it's just a stunning property to look at.
Right.
But it is indicative. But they have also said that there's, you know, the amount of searches in regional areas has grown significantly in the last 2 months as a part of it. But the data around rental and property values is kind of supporting this as well. So the latest CoreLogic data that came out at the end of June talked about the quarterly change in property values. And I think we touched on this briefly last episode about how, you know, there's a lot of speak in the marketplace, or not in the marketplace, but in the media about, you know, property dropping significantly and we're going to fall off a cliff. Whereas the actual data is showing that the market's been quite resilient. And we mentioned that the data showed that Australia's national dwelling value had dropped 0.8% for the quarter, but was still up significantly over a 12-month period. The part I wanted to add to that we didn't touch on last week was that even though the Australian dwelling values were down 0.8, when you look at how that came about, the drop was 1.1% in the capital cities, but it was actually a growth of 0.3% in the regional areas.
Right. Okay.
So it's showing that the regional areas are already outperforming the capital cities. So whether that's indicative of what's happening in COVID and the trend that we sort of just alluded to, it's sort of showing that it may already be beginning. And some of the best performing suburbs, if we look at growth rates over the last 3 and 12 months, are actually coastal towns, especially in Queensland. Some of the areas in the Sunshine Coast are showing median values growing at a higher rate than virtually anywhere else in the country.
Yeah, right.
I understand why. It's nice and warm.
Yes. So that's a trend I think we need to monitor, but I certainly think there'll be a lot more remote working. Whether it'll be as significant as people are starting to expect, I think part of the reason remote working's being able to work so well at the moment is there's still a lot of restrictions, so people are stuck at home, so they may as well work. I think a few businesses may have a reality check when suddenly people can go to shops and cafes and sports and restaurants. Not having them in the office may lead to some accountability issues, I would imagine.
Look, Brett, you know, the interesting thing is we started to allow staff to come back into the office, as the restrictions were easing up, they weren't coming in all the time. They were coming in for a day here and a day there. And as soon as I announced this week that we wanted them all to go back home for 6 weeks, the number of staff that actually said that they were really, really wanted to try and come into the office to do their work because they found it much easier and more convenient to be in that environment, I was actually a little bit surprised by. When we did our survey of our staff, it turned out that most of the staff said they preferred to work in the office around about 3 to 4 days a week and having the ability to work from home maybe 1 to 2 days a week. Mm. And that was broadly the consensus across most of our staff in terms of, you know, how they wanted to how they thought that the more ideal balance between working from home and working from the office might be post-COVID.
Funny, isn't it, though, when you set those dates for people and say to them, I don't know, you're working Monday to Wednesday in the office, it's still funny, like human nature is a strange one, because then you go, oh, I've got to go to work from Monday to Wednesday. It doesn't seem to matter. You know, your mind still seems to catch up and say that's annoying that you've got those 3 days. It's almost like I think people would just prefer to choose when they decide to come into an office and when they don't. But it's funny when you've got set days, even, I've had that in the past where you go, oh, now I've got to go in. It's kind of annoying. So I think human nature just goes that way. Huh?
I think there's a flip side to that too, Steph, where I think people crave connection as well, where
absolutely
they still want to be connected to the other people in their workplace and the environment, so they want to have some sort of physical presence,
yes,
whether it's as often, you know, maybe not at the 5-day working week that we've had traditionally, but there'll certainly be a level of people wanting to be in the office and even the management
more.
Wanting to make sure they're there to make sure they're understanding the training or the workload.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. I mean, I've done the same thing, you know, throughout the first sort of lockdown period. I was really craving just to go back into the office. If you're sitting at home all day on your computer with no interaction with anyone, and we don't have a pet to even distract or anything, all you're doing is literally just sitting there on a computer from the moment you get up till really quite late at night, isn't it? You know, the work just seems to blend and there's no sort of personal downtime. And I was going to send myself quite crazy by the end of that. So it sort of comes back to that resilience piece and making sure that you are looking after your mental health. So.
Yeah.
Sure, you're not alone there, Steph. I'd imagine there's a lot of people with those circumstances.
Yeah, that's true.
And I've been given this a fair bit of thought, you know, in terms of what our office configuration might look like. I mean, if we were to have all of our staff come into the office, we just wouldn't have enough seats for half of the team to sit in the office these days. Mm-hmm. So we're probably going to be close to around about 40 staff within about 6 to 8 weeks. And I'm sort of the view that we might only have space for maybe 70 to 75% of those staff sort of rotate the teams through so that
I was just going to say, Joel, a lot of organizations, even, you know, like the one that I work for myself, reduce the amount of desks in the office because people were either out on the road or we were never at capacity.
Yeah.
What was the point of having all these desks?
I think good employers will recognize a few things out of that, because where an employee says, I really enjoy working from home, what they're really saying is at home there is an environment where I can work better. And for some people that's going to be true, and for some people that's going to be false. And it depends on where they live
and your circumstances.
Kids or not and circumstances and all those things. And I think the good employers will learn about how they can design their workplace and workspace, including considering homework options. And I think your employers who are really on the forefront of this are the ones that we already know about. Like you hear stories about Google and the workplace environments that they create.
Yeah.
But the distinction I'll take from that is if you're going to have a good functioning workspace, well, then you need to understand how your employees need to work.
Yeah.
So if you have people whose job is to log on onto their computer and be at their computer from 9 to 5, then what is the environment that supports it and how do you make that work? But if you've got an environment which is a mixture of people needing to talk to each other and interact and have meetings, but then also for times of their day, they need to have concentration time. We certainly have in our workplace, the need for team collaboration, but then people need to be able to go away and do their work.
Correct.
And that's, I think in our case, that might be why people have a preference for working some days at home. Mm. It's actually because that's the only time they get hours at a time without being interrupted.
Yep. Couldn't agree with more.
So your workplaces in the future, if I was to design the ideal office space right now with no constraints on money, because of course office space is expensive and you have to pay for it, but I would have one area of the workplace as it is right now where you've got your desks next to each other for people to work in amongst other people, but then I'd have a separate part of the office where people can take their computer, their laptop computer, and go to another side of the office, which is the designated quiet area.
Yeah, we've got that in my business.
Perfect. Yep. If someone's sitting there, you can't talk to them. You can't interrupt them because they need 2 hours of time to get that job done.
We've got exactly that, Louis, and they're sort of desks that have actually got sort of almost like wings on the side so that you sort of block out any noise.
Yep.
And it's called the library, and you don't wander over there unless you're
That's
having
it.
Quiet time, and that is out. Yeah. So, but we've also got quite a lot of sort of collaboration space as well, where teams can come together. You know, stand around a board and sort of nut out projects and put things up and have that sort of chat. And then you've got your own sort of desk. The only other interesting part that I think this is going to sort of pose a bit of a challenge to is the fact that we're all at hot desking at the moment, particularly in my business and a lot of businesses out there. What happens to the hot desk at the moment, given the circumstances of, you know, carrying germs onto desks, and, you know, will it actually turn around again and we'll have to sit in same desks, or will it just be a hygienic clean every time you leave that desk and move on to the next team? So that's one that I'm curious to see how that unfolds.
I can see an environment, Steph, where it's similar to what we saw at the gym for those couple of weeks, where basically there was some wipe down antiseptic wipes that are just sitting on each of those workstations, and then, you know, and as you come in, you wipe down your desk and the screen and maybe the keyboard that you're using, and then I could sort of see it working like that.
Probably when we get through this next 6-week lockdown, I think it will, for sure. But I think businesses will need to change their tacks, the way forward, and then we'll need to be more flexibility and other options out there, because it won't be the same workplace when we come out of this. So that's for sure.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. All right.
Well, just before we move on to another section, it'd be remiss not to quickly touch on the home loan deferrals. So obviously there was a lot of concern about this impending cliff, as it's been called, potentially coming in September when the home loan deferrals and potentially the end of JobKeeper came about. Good news is that the banks have all agreed to extend those loan deferrals for another 4 months through to January now. So near on 800,000 mortgage holders or business and residential loans have been have got deferral rights up until January next year to a total of around $236 billion. So that'll help any people that aren't working and aren't able to pay those loans in the short term.
Now, Brett, is that just in Victoria or is that across Australia?
No, I believe that's nationwide.
Right, okay.
It is nationwide. Yeah. Consumers need to be aware that it's not an automatic qualification. The banks are going to be very scrupulous in trying to get people who can repay back onto repayment programs. And what they don't want is just to kick the cliff 4 months further down the road. Mm-hmm. So even some of the quotes that I've been seeing is banking people saying the worst thing to do is to take someone who's going to default anyway and just defer it for another 4 months, because then you've got another 4 months of interest accruing on that loan that they're going to default on. So yeah, sure. So the banks are going to be pretty tight on it.
I understand that rationale.
Yeah. So there'll be a process, but at least the relief's there if it's warranted.
Yeah.
Yep.
All right, guys, we're going to go to another very quick break, and we'll come back just with Joel just to give a final sort of market update for us. We'll be back after this message.
Are you concerned about your finances? Maybe you're not sure if you'll have enough money to retire on. Or maybe you've received a redundancy, inheritance, or even a significant promotion, or perhaps a life-changing medical diagnosis. Regardless of your concern or financial position, United Global Capital's advisors are experts in the areas of strategic financial planning, taxation, superannuation and self-managed superannuation funds, risk management, estate planning, and investments. Don't let fate dictate your financial future. Take control today and contact United Global Capital for a no-cost, no-obligation financial strategy consultation. Simply call 03 8657 7640 or email info@ugc.net.au and book your appointment today.
Welcome back. Joel, what can you give us an update on with the market at the moment? What's the mood out there?
Well, I think we're starting to get some inquiry from clients just wondering how long the performance of their share portfolios can continue to perform the way that they have been before we see another big dip. I think that what has happened really in the last 4 months is there's been this huge dichotomy between who the winners are in this stock market recovery and who are the laggards. And no doubt the types of businesses that we prefer to invest in, being those high quality, really visible recurring or visible revenue generators, have benefited from this environment. So, you know, obviously our portfolios can be tied in or at least match with what a lot of the NASDAQ stocks have done. We tend to be focused more in the technology, software, e-commerce, healthcare, biotechnology space. We just find that those businesses tend to have much better revenue models and give us a lot more comfort around what those businesses are likely to generate in terms of revenues and profits moving forward. And the market appears to be rewarding a lot of those businesses with the recent performance. We've seen the NASDAQ has consistently gone to new all-time highs. And in fact, if I just pull up a chart of the NASDAQ right now, I haven't actually got proper stats here, but if we're having a look at the NASDAQ was trading at around about, it peaked at a level of 9,752 on the 20th of February, and then obviously went into the decline for the next month. Today it's trading at 10,745, so that would represent a gain of somewhere around about 11-12% above where the NASDAQ was on the 20th of February when this whole COVID-19 crisis started. But then when we have a look at how the US S&P 500, the broadest index of US stock performance, that market is still today trading at 3,154, having peaked at a high of 3,396. So it's still somewhere around about sort of 7% off its highs that were reached on the 20th of February when this COVID market started. And then having a look at the Australian stock market, the XJO or the ASX 200, today our market is trading at 5,920 and it peaked at 7,162, I think it was. Yeah, 7,162, I think it was. Anyway, so our market is still down some sort of 13-14% off its all-time highs. So, you know, I guess what we need to ask the question is, well, how long can this market start to continue to perform how it has been? And really, when we're looking at it, we're looking at how long can the NASDAQ continue to perform as strong as how it has been? And the true answer is that right now we're starting to see some divergences in the momentum and the strength of the NASDAQ. We've seen that when we look at a range of different momentum measures, including the RSI, the Relative Strength Index, we look at the oscillator, they're not confirming this most recent push higher. However, we are seeing that, and we're also seeing a really strong level of bullish sentiment in the NASDAQ as well. We're seeing call option buying is at a really strong level. And we're also seeing that that much of the drive in stock prices in the NASDAQ has really come from the large cap technology space, thinking of your Microsofts, your Amazons, your Googles, your Apples, these types of businesses.
Yeah.
So I thought it'd be worthwhile just taking a look at how our economic model is shaping up and seeing whether or not there might be opportunities outside of the technology space and those large cap Nasdaqs, because I think there is a limit to how far these businesses can run before we need to see other parts of the market start to play catch up. So there was a recent study that was just published this week from Sentiment Trader. They do some really great work in analyzing what takes place after certain market events have occurred. And what they've noted is that the rally in the S&P 500, which is actually being a laggard at the moment compared to the Nasdaq, the rally in the S&P 500 has been one of the strongest rallies ever recorded, while the fear index, the VIX, still remains at a fairly elevated level. Now, they've gone back and taken a look at how the S&P 500 has performed in similar circumstances. So generally, if everything is okay and stock markets are trading with a you know, relatively normal level of volatility, you'll see the VIX somewhere between sort of 12 and 15. At the moment, the volatility index, the VIX index, is currently trading above 20. It currently trades at around about 23 at the moment on the S&P 500. So when they've gone back and had a look at how the S&P 500 has performed after it's engaged in a 20% rally in a three-month period while the VIX index remains above 23, there's only been five instances prior to this this most recent instance where this has occurred. The first time was back in October of 1970. The second instance was back in February of 1975. The third in July of 1980. The fourth in October of 1982, and the fifth was in May of 2009. And in each of those instances, if we look forward over 2 months, 3 months, 6 months, and 1 year, the stock market was up 100% of the time on each of those time frames for a median return of 4.8% over 2 months, 8.3% over 3 months, 16.6% over 6 months, and over 12 months, a return of 21.6%. So what it suggests is that although we have seen a really remarkable rally in the Nasdaq, if we're looking at seeing a broadening of that stock market take place, the odds are pretty strong that the S&P 500 will soon join the strength that the Nasdaq is showing. And in fact, I wouldn't be surprised, given the frothiness of the Nasdaq and some of those big technology companies, that we start to see a rotation out of those stocks into more old world industrial based type businesses that have sort of lagged this recovery. And also money coming out of those large cap stocks into mid cap and small cap stocks. In fact, a lot of the screens that we're running right now trying to find stocks that we might add to our portfolios over the next few months, we're seeing a lot of stocks popping up in that mid cap and small cap end of the market that are setting up quite nicely and, you know, within sort of 3 to 6 weeks could be in a position that we would be buying those stocks if they met our fundamental criteria.
Joel, I was going to ask another quick question too. I mean, there's been a little bit of talk about manufacturing returning to Australia, and that being a sector that's going to grow because we've become too reliant on the overseas market. Do you think that is something that's likely to return?
I think that it's possible. I don't think it's all going to return back to Australia because there are certainly some cost disadvantages from manufacturing here in Australia. We're a high-wage nation. And we have the tyranny of distance as well, which makes our ability to get to produce goods cheaply and then export them overseas difficult from a competitive standpoint. However, I think there will be a general shift over the medium to longer term as governments start to realize and as businesses start to realize some of the low-cost areas are becoming less and less friendly, and some of those previously low-cost areas are no longer as low-cost as what they used to be, in particular China, where China was the manufacturer to the world during the 80s and the 90s and the early part of the 2000s. But as their level of wealth has grown and as their living standards have increased, so too have their wages. And now China is finding that that, you know, in order to be able to produce the sorts of goods and services they were previously, they're becoming more uncompetitive due to their higher wages these days. So I think there will be certain industries that will probably become more localized, that might be more, you know, critically dependent to the way that the countries need to survive. They could be strategic assets, they could be strategic manufacturing, there could be defense, could be a whole range of, you know, industries that could be really important where the supply chain may pose a risk. But I don't think all of that manufacturing is going to come back to Australia. I think what it will probably do is probably shift to different jurisdictions from where it is today.
And Steph, keep in mind that finding share market opportunities might be a different thing again. So it might be good for Australia economically to have manufacturing here with employment numbers. But remember that the economy is not necessarily the share market, because the only way to take advantage of manufacturing coming back to Australia is to be able to buy that share on the stock market of that company that is going to be in that sector taking advantage of that opportunity, and doing it in a way where you do have that growth potential.
Ability to buy in,
That's right, yeah. So just keep in mind that separation between the economy and the share market.
So I think, look, at this point in time, I think the message is that, you know, if you're not in Amazon and Google and Apple and Microsoft, I think it's too late to get into those businesses. And I think really most investors should be starting to trawl through the mid-cap and small-cap areas of the market and some of those industrial stocks that may have lagged this recovery, because I think that based on the evidence that we're seeing, we're probably due for a bit of a correction in the leaders so far. And when that correction starts to take place, there's reasonable evidence to suggest that other areas of the market will probably start to find some strength. And we're already seeing that even in our income portfolio, which has lagged the recovery to some degree. But in the last 6 weeks or so, our income portfolio has started to really make some movements in terms of recovering what was lost.
Yep, one. All right. Well, thanks for that update, Joel. We're now going to go to our final segment of the day, which is You Can't Be Serious. And Lord knows we all need a bit of a laugh at the moment. What have you boys got to start off the segment for us? I might start with Brett, because he's always really good with these. So.
All right, Steph. Well, I don't know whether this will make you laugh or cringe, because this is about a 90-year-old lady in Gatchina, Russia, who's proven to be quite the grouch. There's a swing in her neighbouring garden that she's, over the years, made a couple of attempts. She's tried to dig it out herself. She's charged people wanting to use the swing with shovels. And most recently, she's now been caught spreading human feces on them.
Oh gosh.
Wow.
What a charmer.
What a charmer, and a 90-year-old at that too. So yeah, must have a love of children.
Oh jeez.
How about you, Louis?
I have a quintessentially Australian story about police pulling over a driver in Queensland going at 123 k's an hour to find a very panic-stricken person driving the car. And what happened was, this guy from Gladstone in Queensland was driving on the highway and found a brown snake at his feet starting to wrap itself around his legs.
Oh, my goodness.
So what does he do? He just finds what happens to be close to his hands while he's driving at 100 k's an hour. So he finds his seatbelt to try and keep the snake off. I'm not sure how you do that. Maybe you take the metal bit. But also what was next to him was a knife.
Lucky.
Now, as you just have in Australia.
Next to you, not a knife.
Just pick up your knife that's right. In his panic, he actually managed to kill the snake while he was braking on the highway.
And then he was charged for possession of a knife.
not quite. So he managed to kill the snake. He stopped his car, but at this point he's in some shock. It's a brown snake, which is a highly venomous snake.
Yeah.
He chucks the body of the snake into the back of his ute, and hops back in the driver's seat, and he just he just guns it and he just goes for hospital as quick as he can. Although that's not as quick as he can, 123 k's an hour. But that's when the cops pulled him over, found out what was happening, and they called an ambulance and found out he was just in shock. He hadn't been bitten. Police said that snakes are actually protected under the Nature Conservation Act. But however, it's a unique situation. I'm not going to press charges. I think they're going to call it self-defense.
Absolutely. Yeah. Only in Australia, right? That
happen. Well, and who said men can't multitask?
Yes, exactly.
That's the reason why you don't travel to Queensland, because they've got things that'll kill you.
That's right. And if you do, just keep a snake next to you.
And a knife.
On the passenger seat. Keep a knife to fend off the snakes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, guys, we all know that the panic buying of toilet paper became a real phenomenon during the peak of the coronavirus shock. And it got so bad, apparently, that that one Oregon police station had to put a note out on its website to advise people that running out of toilet paper is not an emergency worth dialing 911. It's hard to believe the police station said that it's hard to believe that we even have to post this, but do not call 911 just because you ran out of toilet paper. You will survive without our assistance.
Well, I understand how they feel if they don't have toilet paper.
I don't know about you, but I've been in some pretty sticky situations. If I ran out of toilet paper, I would classify that as an emergency worth calling.
I would well agree, Joel. Well agree.
In fact, I'll take you back to this one story. I'll take you to this. I was in Japan, sitting on one of those fancy toilet papers in a shopping center where
fancy toilet, Joel.
Where you've basically got to have an astronaut's degree to be able to work this thing out. There's buttons everywhere. Anyway, I hit the green button, thinking that is the flush. Yeah. Sure enough,
Joel, you missed one important point of the story. He was in the disabled toilet
at
a shopping centre.
Oh, no.
I was in a disabled toilet in a shopping centre, and I'm trying to figure out how I flush the toilet. And I hit this green button, thinking that green button would have been the flush button. And it turns out that it was actually the alarm for distress, the distress button. and the whole shopping center lights up with a big alarm going off.
I was standing there hearing this go off in the middle. I'm thinking, that can only be my husband.
And as I'm in a panic trying to pull up my pants, I hear this knock on the door. I pulled up the pants, opened the door, and sure enough, there's a gentleman there with a face mask on, ready to come in and help me out.
He's in a hazmat suit.
And then I finally catch up with Steph, and she goes, "Was that you?" And I said, and I kept on walking past her, and she goes, "Where are you going?" I said, "I've got to finish." What am I?
I'm so sorry that actually aired. We've actually put this air. Yes, Joel has had many sticky situations with a toilet, and that was absolutely no exception. So I understand why they dial 911.
No more coffee.
And he's rightly sorry to turn up in a hazmat suit if it was Joel.
Well, now we all know each other a little bit better, don't we?
That's exactly right. On a final note, guys, who's going to win the football? I'm sure, Joel, you'd say it's Collingwood.
I'm hoping so. I tell you what, I'm getting sick and tired of losing to Hawthorn.
West Coast going to win for sure.
Thanks for bringing the topic back up, Steph.
You've got the last couple of minutes to banter this out, guys. This is your segment. Go for it.
Mate, who knows? It's that strange. But, of course, we'll stick with the Pies.
Yep.
Good for you guys. Fingers crossed. Otherwise, I have to deal with you bastards next week.
Well, at least you're not the
opposite. Good for everyone when Collingwood win, then.
Well, look, guys, try to have a good weekend. I know it's a little bit difficult, but I hope you guys at least get out for a bit of a walk and a coffee, and the weather stays a little bit nice in Victoria for you guys.
Thank you.
Have a good one. Thanks. And we'll speak to you next week.
Thanks, listeners.
Cheers, guys. Bye.
Bye.